Hello and welcome to the PC Pro podcast as I talk over John Honeywall as he rumbles on in the background at the beginning of the podcast. Hi, John.
Bah, humbug.
Indeed. I also have with me Dr. Darian Grant-Smith.
Good afternoon.
And Mr. Barry Collins.
Well, emphasis on the Mr. there. Steady on.
Well, did you do your PhD in, Barry?
Go away.
Okay, all right, let's start off with you, Doctor, because I think you are covering the Surface launch, are you not?
I drew the short straw on this one. So yesterday Microsoft had a big old event in the Starrett Lehigh building in New York at 10 a.m. their time, 3 p.m. our time. And there'd been some rumours that it might be quite a big deal. A Surface event could well be at this point. You'd reasonably expect it might be just the announcement of the Surface Pro 7. And they did announce that, but there was a whole load of other new stuff as well. Lots and lots to get through. So without any further waffle, I'll tell you some of the new things that have been announced. In reverse order of interest, which is pretty much how they did it, the Surface Laptop 3 is coming, no great surprise there, but there's going to be a new 15-inch model, which is going to be, interestingly, for the first time, it's going to use an AMD processor rather than an Intel one, but the 13-inch one will still have an Intel processor that's going to have, I think, an Ice Lake 10th generation one. There's not a lot that's new here. The trackpad is bigger than it was in the previous Surface laptop, which I think is a good thing because I really like the big trackpads on Apple laptops. That's something I miss with my Surface laptop. And it's got a USB-C connector, but I think it's still got the old standard Surface connector for charging as well. The other interesting thing, I say interesting, is they're ditching, well, they're not entirely ditching, but the Alcantara fabric, you know, the funny sort of carpet texture which you have on a Surface laptop. Some models are keeping that, some are not going to have it anymore. Robin Seller, who's the manager of Surface devices, said, people have different opinions in terms of style, which is a nice, delicate way of putting it. And on a more practical note, he says some commercial customers need to be able to remove germs and sanitize, and one presumes the implication is therefore this kind of carpety fabric was harbouring all sorts of nasties.
That's what you want to hear if you bought one of those, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yes, it's not all that encouraging, but the only other thing...
How's your immune system, Tim?
I'm too ill to tell you. I think, weren't you a bit suspicious of that fabric at the start, John?
I mean Alcantara is a lovely material. It's a man-made material, if I remember rightly. I used to have a friend who had sofas made out of it as a covering, and it was lovely. But it always feels a bit sort of weird on a piece of technology. So I never really thought it was going to work out, and strangely enough, it hasn't.
Yeah, it's strange because it doesn't feel like a nice furry, fluffy fabric. It's kind of, it feels oddly matte and flat, but it is kind of warm. I mean, I do quite like the character it gives to the Surface laptop, but I don't like the way it basically discolours over time. So now I've got two big dark blobs where I rest my palms.
I think the word you're looking for is soiled.
I would prefer not to use that word, thank you, John.
Oh, okay, fine.
It's also got the removable SSD, does it not?
Is that in the Laptop 3? I thought that was in the Pro X. I think you might be going ahead of us there, because the Laptop 3 is supposed to be a little bit more repairable than the previous one, but the news that I heard about the SSD was, as I say, about the Pro X. Since you mentioned that, should we move on, since we've got so many Surface devices to get through?
Yep, go for it.
Well, the Pro X is arguably the most interesting one. Arguably, you might think there's something else, but let's talk about the Pro X for now. This is a 13-inch thing, which looks a lot like the Surface Pro. It's got the same 3:2 ratio screen, but it's based on Microsoft's own ARM-based chipset. So it's called SQ1, which they've co-developed with Qualcomm. And this delivers, they tell us, 3 times the performance per watt of the Surface Pro 6. Now, obviously, you'll have to actually get it in and find out what kind of performance that really translates to, because performance per watt is a bit of a slippery metric. But they're saying up to 13 hours of battery life. Do you know what? App support is something they haven't really talked at.
Well, they haven't, but they've hinted, haven't they? Because they've talked about this one core platform, which they actually announced years ago, didn't they, John? I think they started talking about one core. And then it just fades into
the word wanker. Of course, you only need to say that a bit drunk, and it sounds rather rude.
Maybe that's why they don't talk about it.
That's probably why they don't talk about it. Yeah, I mean, the idea here is that you can run Win32 32-bit apps on it natively on this hardware, as far as I can remember it. I mean, there's been this sort of Snapdragon running Intel stuff for a while, and every time I've ever got my paws on one, it's kind of disappointed badly, because it's quite sort of random as to what things work and what things don't work, as is the nature of sort of emulations and subsystems and so forth. I'm intrigued that they're having yet another go at WinRT, basically, which did so well first time round. And maybe the whole experience will be better this time round. I don't know. I think the lack of Win64 support is going to be probably one of the bigger issues as software vendors move their platforms, their applications over to the 64-bit version.
Yes, but it's all... So you will have better understanding of this than I will, John, but I assumed that with one core support, it would be relatively easy, because the basic infrastructure is the same, to just adapt it for the...
Go back to WinRT, which was straight ARM with no sort of Intel subsystem-y thing, then Microsoft said, no, you can't possibly... develop third-party apps for it, if you remember.
But
of course, that didn't apply to the Microsoft Office team, who did a port. This time round, you know, obviously they're going to be much more open about developing ARM-based apps for the Windows platform, and that's a good thing. So, in a sense, that's a significant piece of movement forward. The question here always will be, how many software companies are going to do that if their Win32 app runs reasonably well?
None.
Well, it depends on the size of the universe, doesn't it? It always depends on the size of the universe. If this thing departs from Microsoft stores in the millions, then, yeah, do you know what? Software developers will be interested.
Maybe it will, but the problem here, of course, is Microsoft has a like many vendors, I'm not just going to pick Microsoft out here, Microsoft has a history of dropping things it doesn't really like, and WinRT was a particularly good example where there was some very interesting tech there screwed up by the dev and the marketing teams, which should have done really well and didn't. And what's going to happen this time round? Microsoft likes to think in the billions. And so if you don't sell vast numbers of something, you're deemed to be a failure and they'll drop it like a hot potato. So would I, as a software developer, want to produce either an optimized Win32 app that worked well or an ARM version of my Windows app that worked well for something that might not be around in 2-3 years time? And as a customer, whether I'm a home customer or a corporate customer, you know, where look at the lack of support now for WinRT, basically. So, you know, it's an interesting avenue, and it's something that Microsoft clearly should be doing, which is looking at alternatives to Intel. The question is it a strong enough offering? And I'm still not sure.
I do have to say that compared to 7 years ago, when Windows 8 came along, Windows RT and all of that, sort of the rise of the Chromebook and so on has kind of persuaded me, and just the change in the way that we work. I do feel a lot more confident about the idea of having a laptop which only runs a browser and Office, and maybe the reassurance that one or two old Win32 apps will run in containers is all I need to get me on board in a way that I definitely wouldn't have said, as I say, at the old Microsoft Surface or whatever.
Oh, absolutely. But the proof of the pudding will be in the eating of it and seeing how the market reacts to it and so forth. At the moment, I'd like to think I was confident about it, but we'll have to wait and see.
It's the why is the question, because there is no strong, compelling reason to go for that even more restricted device than there is for a Windows device. The form factors are roughly the same. Battery life is not a million miles different. So why limit yourself? It didn't make any sense for Windows RT. It doesn't make any sense now.
It's also going to be pretty darn expensive from what I can see. So
what have you seen, Tim?
So I went onto Microsoft Store earlier today to see if I could pre-order this. This is out in November, by the way, this one. The laptop, I believe that one's out in November as well, and the yep. Surface Pro 7 is October. But the... their store mechanism doesn't work very well. I don't know if you actually try to buy one. Quite often it doesn't actually load, and so it just says, "Oh, error," that kind of takes you back to the previous page.
That's not an important part of the customer journey, is it? After all, I can understand them not investing much in that.
But what I've seen is a from $999 price.
Yes,
and then you've got to have £130 for the keyboard. And £130 for the super slim pen that slots into the keyboard.
Yes, okay.
Which is a bit ridiculous.
Yes, that does work out quite a bit more than the Surface Pro 7. I'll just cram this in here. There's really not a lot to say about the Surface Pro 7, so we can just kind of dispatch it very quickly. No, can we not?
Just before we do, I think it's worth... I know we're going to talk about the iPod OS in a second, but... Okay, so Barry is prime territory, I'd say, for this device. Barry loves his iPad Pro more than life itself. More than your children, would you say, Barry?
It's a close one thing, certainly.
It's a close one. And in terms of cost, we're looking at pretty similar.
The kids are much more expensive.
Yeah. I was more thinking of the iPad versus the... So would you even contemplate buying this... when it's $1,260, when you can buy such a high quality iPad Pro for a similar amount?
No, iPad Pro is much less than that. The iPad Pro I got with a keyboard and a stylus comes to less than £1,000. I think it was $890. So you're talking another £400 for a device that won't have anywhere near the app support and offers no compelling advantage. It's no. And this is the problem with these devices, and they've done it for years. It's just they don't learn their lessons, and I find it astonishing that even under different CEOs and God knows what, they continue to make the same mistakes time and again.
All right, Darren, I just wanted to get that comparison in.
Sure.
By all means, move on to the Surface Pro 7.
Well, there's not a lot to say about the Surface Pro 7. If you've seen the Surface Pro 6, then you've basically seen the 7. The differences are very much under the hood. Again, they're moving up to 10th generation Ice Lake CPUs. The most radical change, there's two changes which I welcome, but no one's going to get really excited about them except possibly me. One is it now has a USB-C port instead of an old, in addition to the USB-A one. And it's got 802.11ax. Hooray! The next generation of Wi-Fi is finally starting to trickle through on consumer devices.
So expensive, though.
$749 for the bare thing. Admittedly, that's going to be with 8 gig and 128 gig of storage and no keyboard. So you're going to need to obviously bulk that up a bit to make it useful. But it doesn't feel to me like a pricey machine, just like a reasonably priced prestige quality device.
Well, I think they've got the same trick as they always do. So again, this is the UK price I looked earlier. So $799 is the starting price, and as you say, that's with 128. Mm-hmm. Who's going to buy it with 128? Plus 149, plus 100.
149
keyboard.
Okay.
Plus another 100.
I'm sure there are cheaper keyboards than that, but okay.
Moderate my language, the not-so-good keyboard for 130, I think it is. But then you've got the pen for 100, and that's the very base spec. And I don't think anyone will buy that, and they'll absolutely hit you on the upgrades. Now, the actual one you can pre-order, if you manage to go through all the bars that they place in your way, Core i7. No, this is 10th gen Intel Core, so pretty nice chip, actually, with good graphics. I won't go into that too much. So 16 gigabytes of RAM, 512 gigabyte SSD. How much is that going to cost you?
$14.99.
Good guess, $22.49.
Whoa! God. That is quite Jesus. Hard.
That's robust, isn't it?
that is robust, as you say. And bear in mind that Core i7, because it's such a slim device, won't actually be able to fulfill its full potential. Even you wouldn't buy that, would you, John?
No.
So, I don't know. I do like the Surface kit, and I think we've been a bit negative, haven't we? But it's hard to get excited by those three. I really want to see the Surface Pro X. I really do, and actually try that for myself, because I think possibly, unlike Barry, I might be swearable.
Some people who've got hands on with it in New York have said that although it's the same nominal size as the Surface Pro 7, it's got thinner bezels and it's a thinner chassis, and it somehow feels like a much more portable device, even though a lot of that is psychological rather than rather than physics.
Shall we talk about the other two products they kind of talked about?
Other two products? So you don't want to talk about the Surface earbuds then?
They look awful.
Do they? What looks
bloody great round circle thing you shove in your lug? It looks horrible.
Well, the thing I thought was quite interesting about that, there's a thing I like about them, which is that they're supposed to integrate with Windows, so they become another input device. So as well as just controlling your music playback from whatever, from your phone or whatever, you can also, the example they gave was tap your headphone to advance slides in PowerPoint, which I thought was...
Oh, my flipping hell.
There you go. Killer application right there.
Killer application for every Microsoft employee. Yeah.
Yes.
Don't you know that Microsoft mainly makes products for Microsoft?
Well, I've been saying that for years.
Mm. Yeah.
25 of them, actually.
Okay, so go on. Let's go to the two more kind of forward-thinking products, Darian.
Okay, well, the first one, which certainly turns some heads, is what's called the Surface Neo, which is basically like a folding clamshell tablet-y thing. It's got two 9-inch displays stuck together by a spine like a book with a 360-degree hinge, so you can turn it around and have it in double facing outward tent mode, or you can prop it up and read it like a book, or you can use it like in all the many ways that we're already using our folding devices, which is, it's a bit of a concept. I mean, they've said it is going to be released, but not for another, where are we, like 14 months, to say Christmas 2020. So it's definitely a work in progress at the moment, but they're trying to do something new. And one of the new things they're doing is that although it's basically two flat touch screens, there's also a Bluetooth keyboard which attaches to one of the screens with magnets, so you can just kind of snap it on and turn it into a much more classic laptop-style form factor. And the keyboard doesn't cover the entire bottom screen, so you can use the top half of the screen as a sort of touch bar thing, or you can slide it up and use the bottom half as an enormous trackpad. I'm very much yet to be convinced, but I'm also quite interested and excited that they're trying something new, and this is certainly new.
Yeah, I actually think it's really interesting. I love the fact they're doing something new and pushing the envelope of what you can do with Windows kind of devices. Although this again uses Windows 10X, we should say, rather than.
We haven't talked about 10X, have we?
Well, Windows 10X is what also runs Surface Pro X.
Yeah, it's the evolution of what we were saying earlier about Windows Core, and it's being, among other things, it's being designed specifically to support multi-screen devices from the word go. There was a whole spiel they did about how when they started developing it, they didn't have any multi-screen devices, so they had to kind of use their imaginations, but now the technology's catching up. So there's this whole new separate but very similar version of Windows called 10X, which I suspect... Personally, that's a confusing fragmentation of the brand, which will shortly be rolled back into the main Windows 10 branch, but we'll see.
I like their little description of it. This device built for blah, 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 for the window on Windows 10X, an expression of Windows 10. So that's so using an expression in an entirely different way to any ways he's previous. Yeah. We've got
a couple of expressions for it.
Did you say 5.6-inch screens? These are
9-inch. It's like a big. It's like two iPads, kind of. Only I think they're narrower and taller.
Yeah, sorry, I was jumping ahead to the next product. Why not go to that?
Okay, well, the last one, the And One More Thing that they unveiled yesterday, really kind of caused a little bit of a kerfuffle, because Microsoft is getting back into the phone market. After killing off Windows Phone in 2017, they've announced their first proper Microsoft-branded phone product, and it is, as Tim kind of slightly gave away, it's a folding one, but unlike the Samsung one, where they've actually tried to build a crease right into the screen, it is, like the Surface Neo, it's got two separate 5.6-inch displays which fold together with a hinge. It's called the Surface Duo, And the other interesting thing about it, maybe it's not interesting, maybe it's predictable, but it certainly says something about Microsoft, about how Microsoft sees its role in the coming technological generation, is that it runs Android. They promise greater cross-functionality between Windows 10 and Android than on previous devices, but basically it runs Android and you can get your apps from the Google Play Store. So that's Microsoft officially, I think, throwing in the
towel. How the mighty hath fallen.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's going back to the previous, you know, foldy thing. I think I'm absolutely with Tim, and I think it's really good that Microsoft is innovating and is trying stuff. It's very easy to sit on the sidelines and whinge that they're not innovating, and then whinge when they do innovate. So and that also applies to the ARM-based thing as well. I mean, I'm genuinely pleased that they're trying to do this stuff and push the boundaries. I just worry about their longer term commitment to these things, because in the past they've been shown to be a little bit feisty on that front. So the folding thing and Windows 10X I think is interesting. I don't believe the whole spiel about expression. I'm sorry, I just want to slap the marketing person around the face for whoever came up with that line. This is the new core Windows. This is the work that they've been doing on this new sort of alternative Windows core platform thing, and that is a very good thing, and it's good to see that work happening. The problem I have is I would be an awful lot happier if it wasn't called sort of Windows X, which kind of sounds like Windows 10.
It's Windows 10X, it's Windows 10, well, 10, or
I know, which is just well, they call it 100 then, for God's sake, you know. I would be happy if they called it something else and actually had a new platform and said, this is a line in the sand, this is something new, this is something different, and we're moving forward. And that they actually said Windows 10 is now you know, not end of life, but it's in sort of support line kind of thing. And that's fine. And I don't have a problem with that. And I wish they had sort of the courage of their convictions to actually do something like that. And I think they would get a lot more credibility and with their customer base, rather than to try and pretend that everything is still Windows and still lovely and is all out like it always was. I don't buy the line that you need to have a new version of Windows in order to work on two screens. That's just nonsense. And I would also point you in the direction of those sort of add-on screen things that they tried punting a few years ago.
Windows Sideshow.
Sideshow, there you go. I couldn't remember the name of it. It was so irrelevant.
I can't believe I could, but there we go.
well done, dear sir, yes. So, you know, from that point of view, I think it's good that they're doing this. The Windows, are they calling it the mobile phone thing with Android? Are they calling that Android, or are they calling it Windowsy or Android or something?
Sorry, there seems to be a paper avalanche happening behind you. Someone's...
Are they still branding it as Windows, or are they calling it something else? Are they calling it Android? I'm not sure.
I haven't actually gone and carefully monitored the language, to be honest. It'll be interesting to see how they... This is another thing to be clear, that they're actually not bringing out until 2020, so they've got plenty of time to refine the marketing message.
Now, from this point of view, you know, the fact that Microsoft is using the Chrome engine thing to do the new version of Edge, or Credge, as we like to call it, good pragmatic solution that will, you know, it's a good thing, because Edge as it stands at the moment is a hideous little runt of a thing that first thing you do is install a grown-up browser, and unfortunately for most people that's Google Chrome, and that brings along all of the nonsense that having a Google product brings. So Credge is a good thing, and Microsoft using Android I think is a good thing, and it's a good pragmatic answer.
Okay, and I'll just bring in, before we move on to the next topic, because I imagine that David Artist, who's very annoyed at us for talking so much about Microsoft in the first place, probably frothing at the mouth by now. But Potster says, the interesting thing for me is that they have announced the phone device so early to get the app devs on board. There are some intriguing possibility for Android apps over two screens.
However, yes, true, but let me just point out, where does this take Microsoft's dev story? Okay, because only a couple of years ago, the whole developer story from Microsoft was, you can write Windows app and then deploy them on Android and all of this stuff. Is that really, you know, with the sort of the mono stuff and all the rest of it, if it's actually just going to be straightforward Android and the customers are going to go buy apps from the Android store, where does that take Microsoft's development story? It's going to be a very interesting to see how well they can pull that one off.
Okay. All right, then. Let us move on to the next item on the agenda. And it's with you, I believe, Barry.
Yes, this is the new version of the iPad OS. Well, in fact, it's the first version of the iPad OS. So they've now officially forked iOS into specific versions for big screen devices like the iPad and the regular iPhones. And so this came out last week, and there's it was sort of heralded as a big thing, and I'm actually a little bit disappointed at how minor it actually feels in the end. But the main selling points are better multitasking. So you know, iPad owners, I'm sure, are pretty used to this sort of split screen view, the ability to sort of have little windows to the side now, whereas previously you were just stuck with the one app and you had to switch between the windows. They've made it easier to have multiple different little bars of windows of apps running simultaneously. The usefulness of that, I don't know. It's sort of okay. I mean, I'm sitting here with sort of a browser window open in front of me. I've got a Twitter thing running down the side. I can have, you know, Facebook, other apps in these little slender slivers running down the side of the screen, and you can flick between them. I have to say that none of this is very intuitive. I had to go online and watch videos to work out how to do it. And they also all depend on having the app in the dock. So you even need to put like all of your regularly used apps in the dock itself, or hope that it appears there automatically because it puts recently used apps in that area. So it's sort of like, it feels like iPad OS is trying to move more towards the Mac OS, but it doesn't quite get there for me.
And what's your thoughts on it, John? Because I know you have some.
Yeah, it's actually as has been said, it's actually a remarkably small set of changes given the renaming of it from iOS to iPad OS. In one sense, it's because actually iOS on iPad worked reasonably well, and you know, the changes are not monumental. I like them. I like the things that they're doing there, and I think it was worth the bifurcation and coming clean about the platform-specific capabilities. I also agree that some of the gestures are Byzantine, and you really do have to sit down and learn them. And actually, it would be an awful lot more useful if Apple had some sort of walkthrough tutorial about some of these things that popped up for new users to show you what was going on there. So I like the changes. I appreciate them. It feels now a very polished and complete platform, and for that you know, as iPad goes into what is it 10 years old yet? No, it can't be, but about 7-8 years old. I think it's a good set of changes and welcome. That's quite aside from the whole issues of iOS 13, 13.1, 13.11 and so forth, which have been plaguing us over the last couple of weeks.
Well, go on then, John. You've touched upon that. Are you just talking about the stability issues?
Well, I mean, stability, yes. I mean, I put iOS 13.0 on my phone when it came out, and I was able to actually kernel panic it quite easily with a few third-party apps. And 13.1 came along, which was, for me, no better. And then 13.1.1 came along, and that was considerably better, and now we're on 13.1.2, I think, with 13.2 in beta. So it's, you know, this is becoming a little bit of an unfortunate habit for Apple, which is to release something to a date which is tied to a hardware launch, in this case the new phones, which require iOS 13 as the base starting platform. And it doesn't, you know, I think they should be a little bit more cautious about maybe more staggered release here, because the old excuse about having a small number of pieces of hardware to target is wearing a little bit thin now.
Yes, but they have their big announcement, John. They've got to have everything ready for the big announcement.
Yeah, and that's a sort of a triumph of marketing over common sense. I mean, yeah. I wouldn't mind if they launched iOS 13 on the new hardware and said, you know, we've still got another month of beta testing for the existing hardware. I don't think that would be an unreasonable thing to do.
that plays against a whole splintering argument. Well, certainly they used to use against Android, wasn't it? That you never knew which version of Android your device run, whereas every iOS device
gets away with like 4 weeks or something. You know, obviously you don't want to get into a Android style multi-version splintering, but I don't know. It's this time the experience seems to have been worse than last year, and that wasn't terribly good.
Okay, so the overall conclusion then from the two of you appears to be a bit meh about iPadOS.
iPadOS. No, I think it's a good thing, and I think it's a good polish, and I think it's a welcome focusing on the iPad again and focusing on the capabilities that you want on a device of that form factor.
Okay, let me rephrase it. So there are lots of us who bought an iPad, kind of thought, well, I'll definitely use it, but then ended up not using it. Is this transformative enough that it will actually win us back?
I don't think so. I don't think it's not a massive game changer from what went before. I mean, you know, other nice touches are these like sort of today widgets that now appear on your home screen. They've finally changed the icon size so that you don't have these whopping great icons on the screen. They put a lot more app icons. So, you know, the sort of display density is much better used. The other big thing, actually, I've not actually tried yet, is the ability to insert external storage and run files of external storage. But the whole...
I've done that, and it works great.
Yeah, that's good. But the whole Apple file system thing is still an utter mess. I don't know why they make that so tricky. I find it almost impossible to ever find anything I've saved on the iPad. You know, I think, you know, we said earlier, I think the iPad Pro with a keyboard, or any iPad with a keyboard, and this new update, it feels a much more comfortable semi-laptop than it was previously.
Agreed. And the one bit I haven't yet tried in anger is using it as a second screen alongside a Mac, which you can do.
Yeah, you could do it with that previously, couldn't you? And you can still do it with Windows. I think, I can't remember what the app's called.
Yeah, there's a third-party app, but this is actually built into the OS.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So I'll completely revise what I said before then. So it's not meh. It's more kind of you hope for more, but actually this is a nice refresh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Let us move on to the third story, because actually time is sweeping us along. Darian, don't hide yourself away. Tell us what's happening.
Lovely segue, thank you. Well, this is some new security and privacy, well, just privacy announcements from Google. It's been widely reported. It was posted on Google's own blog, but I quite liked the Verge headline, which was Google announces three new ways to hide your personal activity from Google. This is at the start of Cybersecurity Awareness Month. Google has announced that, first of all, this is momentous news, incognito mode is coming to Google Maps. It's already come to, well, obviously, you know, it's been in Chrome for 10 years now, and it's recently came to YouTube. And now when you use Google Maps on your phone, not on your desktop, that's a whole different approach, but when you use it on Android or iOS, in future you'll have the option of switching to incognito mode, and the places you search for won't be saved to your Google account, and the places you've been won't be used to customize Google's profile of you, and so forth. So you'll be able to travel and take advantage of Google Maps without without Google in turn effectively spying on your movements.
So I haven't looked into the mechanics of this. How is that going to work on a phone?
Yeah.
I guess this is a very good question, because all I've got to go on is the blog post, which currently is really rather breezy about the technical details. I infer from the quite precise language that Google's Eric Miralia, Director of Product Management, Privacy and Data Protection, from the language he uses, it seems like specifically the Google Maps product and service will not learn anything about what you're doing in incognito mode. That doesn't guarantee that other things running on your phone won't still track your locations and your, well, I guess, I don't know how the reviews API is managed, all that stuff. Now, well, this kind of feeds into a bigger question, a bigger issue I was going to get to after talking about the other ones, because basically, although it's quite welcome that Google is taking steps to help you safeguard your privacy, what it's really doing is shining a light on just how messy and confusing the privacy situation currently is and how difficult it is to really know exactly what's being tracked by what.
I kind of get the feeling that they're doing this simply so that they've got something that they can wave at people who are moaning at them about privacy, that they are, quote, doing something about it, unquote. It's kind of more of a PR spin around the edges rather than anything particularly core to their business, because if they really did privacy properly for their business, they wouldn't have a business.
Mm, yes.
No, I was just thinking it's that so the underlying issue here is about anonymization. So actually a lot of the data that Google collects is good. You know, we all benefit from it. I'm particularly thinking about Google Maps and being able to see if there's a problem on the roads, because I'm told, due to all the other users of Google Maps who are sharing their data, you know, that's a good thing. That doesn't mean necessarily that I want Google to know exactly where I was at 7 p.m. yesterday evening. So there's kind of this, I'm struggling to put it into words, but you've got this mass usage of data, which is homogenous and kind of good. And then you've got this detailed user data, which where Google basically knows so much about you. And it knows so much about all of us. That it needs to do something. And I think I kind of agree with John that it's kind of fiddling around the edges, but it also, in the next few years, I think this is going to become a much, much bigger question. And there's going to be much more awareness about data. And these companies will need to have a straight answer to when I say, well, I don't want you to have that data. And you go, sure. Okay, here it goes. Here's the way to get rid of it. Thanks very much. Bye.
Mm. Well, it's a little bit ambiguous, because Google, I've just been checking out the precise wording, and it says that when you're in incognito mode, places you go won't be saved to your location history. But what that actually means in terms of the effect on Google's ability to make use of what it knows about you or what it can track about you is completely unexplored and explained.
The problem is they're not starting from a comfortable starting point, are they? And therefore... And there is a little bit here, sort of, you know, Chicken Little, and was it Chicken Little claiming that the sky was falling down, that they're claiming to be respecting your privacy and claiming to be lovely and claiming to be cuddly and so forth, and everyone stands around saying yes, but, and that the problem is until we can actually audit the data that's held about me or you, or me in my case, you in your case, why should I believe them? And it's a bit like Facebook and privacy. They can claim that there's lots of privacy loveliness going on, and I don't believe a word of it until I can actually audit it myself. But these whole platforms are predicated on not being able to do that. Because I suspect if you did actually be able to do that, you'd be truly terrified about what there was.
Hmm. Well, I mean, it's impossible, though, to really imagine a scenario where an individual could actually audit a company like Google in a way that they could be confident that what they were seeing was really all there was. I mean, there's no way of implementing it, I think.
An awful lot more than you do at the moment, which is basically there is no means of doing anything.
There's bits and bobs, which is kind of, I guess, where we came in on this. And maybe the bits and bobs highlight just how much is not covered. Yeah. But
okay, so Darren, I think we may have interrupted you, possibly. Google Maps we covered.
I was going to tell you these really exciting other things, which are basically very similar. YouTube is now going to let you automatically wipe your history. You have three options. You can say, don't ever automatically wipe my history, but I would like to wipe it clean at the click of a button whenever I choose. Or you can automatically have your history expire after either 3 months or 18 months, which is something they already offer for your location history and your web activity. So it's kind of just expanding that. And, you know, I don't really think that YouTube is a a tremendous security or privacy concern for me, but maybe some people are looking up, I don't know, like guides on how to cheat at some video game or something that they really don't want anyone to know about. And again, it's the same thing. It's a step in a positive sounding direction. What it really means, who knows?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's not video games that people are trying to hide in their YouTube activity.
Well, YouTube's, I mean, it doesn't have the most depraved stuff on it, I believe. I don't know. All right, well, you're experts.
I'm interested in where your minds have both gone. Mine is much more pure. Okay, so is there anything more to say about this before we move on to my story?
Well, just the last bit of the three bits of news was that you can also now tell the Google Assistant, delete the last thing I said to you, or delete everything I said to you last week, and that will be erased from the record. But, you know, same caveats apply.
Yep. Okay, so little steps to the good. I am interested. We'll come back to this in the podcast in 10 years' time. I am interested in where this is going, because data, I think, used to be very boring and just everyone would just switch off. Yeah, whatever. Hmm. But actually, I think now people have been burnt a bit more, and I think this will become a topic that more people are interested in. Hmm. Okay, all right, let us move. We're going right back in history now, Barry. So take us there. Take us to Japan.
Yes, well, this, see, I think, I don't want to slander my dear colleague here, but I think Darian sent this story around this morning thinking, dear, look at those Japanese and themselves clinging on to pages for 50 years, because Japan's last pager provider has just shut down its service after 50 sterling years of people getting beeped and being told to come back to the office. Tokyo Telemessage is shutting down its pager service from midnight. It was a midnight on Monday. So Japan's last pager has beeped its last beep. However, pages are far from dead, and it's actually us over here who are keeping them alive, by and large. So the NHS alone has around 130,000 pages still in it, which, according to the BBC report from earlier this year, is about 10% of the total global total left. And they still cost the NHS £6.5 million a year, which is why Matt Hancock, the health secretary, is quite keen to get shot of them. But pagers do a remarkably good and remarkably simple job, in that they alert you when you're needed, and they often work in places where mobile phone signals don't. They work on a different radio system to the mobile phone, not on the mobile phone network. So especially in hospitals, where there are lots of places where you can't use mobile phones, they're still particularly useful. And there's a little bit of fight back going on. I did a bit of research earlier today from NHS trusts who are sort of fighting back against this idea that all pages must be purged because, as Hancock said, that then the fax machines come from the way of the dinosaurs. In fact, they still do a very good single-use job, and it would be a little bit foolish to just get rid of them without thinking through the consequences.
Okay, but then you could end up with lots of things littering our wards and whatever, because they once served a use. You know, there is a time when the technology has to retire.
Yeah, of course, but where these currently do still have a purpose. You know, these NHS trusts aren't hanging on to them for posterity. They, as I say, they often work in places where mobile phone signals can't be used. And when you think about, you know, how they're used, they're just there to give a message or, you know, to come to a certain ward or whatever. That they have a single purpose. The battery life in them lasts for 5 or 6 days rather than, you know, the less than 24 hours most smartphones work. So, you know, when you think about doctors working ridiculously long shifts, who probably don't want to have their, maybe you can't even get for a whole shift without having their mobile phone topped up. But if their mobile phone's away from them, that page is not much use. So, you know, there are reasons to still use this stuff. And I don't like the idea of just getting rid of stuff because it feels old fashioned. Sometimes stuff has a purpose.
Sorry, you go, John.
Okay, so the thing to bear in mind here is two important points here. One of which is they work on a much lower radio frequency than Wi-Fi, 2.4 or 5 gigahertz, or mobile phones, 800 megs and up. They use the bands I've just looked up here is 138 megahertz, 153 megahertz, and there's 159 megahertz for UK medical use, which apparently is very little use. So lower frequency means it goes further through walls and so forth. The other important point here is a pager doesn't transmit. It's purely a receiver. Now, if you are paranoid about EMC, then having something that receives but doesn't transmit is a good thing. And all of this stuff about using mobile phones in critical areas. However, let's just roll into EN55022, CISPA 22, and the derivatives thereof. If there is anything out there on sale that's being used in a hospital that is susceptible to mobile phone interference, then it's probably illegal. There's a lot of old wives' tales of 30 years ago that really shouldn't apply here. I'm a bit sad to see it go, I guess. I can see the benefit of it, and I can see how it works well as a implementation solution. And I don't think we should assume that mobile phone is the answer to all known problems here. So I think certainly in certain areas like hospital environments and so forth, pagers have a good use.
I was just going to say, I find myself wondering who it is. I'm just showing my ignorance here. Who is operating this completely separate network that, as you say, is on totally different frequencies to the mobile phone and Wi-Fi bands? And, you know, you can't walk into the O2 shop or whatever and just say, I want to buy a pager these days. So I don't actually know who's running this pager network.
You can't. You're right. There's Vodafone, in fact, shut down theirs, I believe, in 2017. And I'm desperately trying to find the tab that I had open with the. There's a one company who's still keeping it alive called Page One, who are part of Capita. Apparently, Page One do most of the provision for the NHS. So they're the sole UK network that's still running these devices.
Yeah, so it does seem like maybe they're not exactly holding us to ransom, but, you know, there is something that we need that only that has a monopoly supplier. And I wonder if there's, you know, I understand the idea that this has been around for so long. When it first came in, it was probably like the most sensible, you know, technologically sound, efficient way of doing things. And now it's a legacy cost, an ongoing one. And while it may well be that, you know, 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi isn't a perfect replacement, is there not something we can do to wean ourselves off this what's now just become a kind of a lingering addiction?
Yeah, I guess so. But and, you know, in the same way the police still use radios, I think it's, yeah, it's just, I think it was John said that you know, mobile phones aren't the panacea for everything. And where there's a specific use case for them, I think part of the problem is, as you say, that this company has a monopoly on the market, that it's cranking up the costs as much as it can push them. So that is a problem. But I don't think that means the device is a bad device.
No.
Okay, let's, before we move on to the hot hardware of the week, can I just check, John, I know that the other two haven't played this goose game, but have you?
The what? Hello, what?
I'm going to take that as a no. Are you aware of this goose game that's done the rounds?
Untitled Goose Game.
That's it.
Is it something that the youth of today are doing?
I think it's all ages. I don't think it's restricted by age. It's weird, but you spent your past week trying not to install it, haven't you, Barry?
I'm trying not to buy it because it's pretty cheap. It's only about 12 quid, I think, from Epic. But yeah, it's basically a game where you play a goose and you have to go around honking at people doing various tasks. It's like a sort of platform puzzle game, but it seems to have swept up everybody for reasons I'm not quite sure. But I'm also hideously tempted to buy it, which is, for reasons I can't explain.
I've gone to the website. It says, it's a lovely morning in the village and you are a horrible goose.
Yeah.
The temptation to stop at that point is very strong.
As I say, very popular. Has anyone... whilst we go on to the Cosmo... before we go on to hot hardware, which is the Cosmo Communicator, if anyone out there in Mixlr land, listening to us live on PC, Mixlr.com/PCPro, wants to admit that they've bought this game, then please do and let us know if you like it. Okay, hot hardware of the week. This is from me because I happened to be in London yesterday and invited to go and see this new device. So, panel, do you know what the Cosmo Communicator is?
Only because I stood by you at CES where you funneled one.
Just to be clear, Cosmo.
I was there for the device. Fondling too.
Oh, yes, okay.
Okay, well, whilst you two are avoiding actually describing it, so it's a Scion Series 5, really.
Reimagined. That's what it is, yeah.
Reimagined for the new age. It's their second iteration of this. So we did have the Gemini PDA, and if you read PC Pro, you'd have seen it. Let's give a good couple of pages to that when it was launched, I think, a couple of years ago now. I lose track. But that was more like a straight copy of the Scion Series 5. It did have phone capabilities, but there was nothing. It was quite tricky to use as a phone, in part because it did not have a screen on the outside. So to actually dial a number, let's say, you would have to open it up. So there's clamshell design, tapping the numbers, you know, awkward. But this time, the Cosmo Communicator does actually have an external screen. It's a very nice AMOLED screen. Sitting in the front of it, by no means taking up the whole display. It's only probably about a third of the size, so of the actual display as a whole. But it's big enough to show you everything you need to see. For example, poking in phone numbers or looking up people in your contacts book. It's actually quite nicely designed because they had to do all that design themselves because it's basically. It's an extension of Android, if you like. So it hooks into Android, but it's working separately to it. What else is there to say about this? It's also got an improved backlit keyboard that hopefully, and from what I've seen, I've only had a short play with this. So I wasn't allowed to take one away. Hopefully, it does look like they've improved some of my criticisms from the first iteration, which were particularly that the space bar was not always perfect to hit. And there's nothing more frustrating when you're typing reasonably quickly and not having the space bar operate. It just, you know, it's so annoying. So that is another big change. It's got support for dual SIMs. It does not yet have support for 5G. That's something they're looking at. But if it will have worldwide support for 4G properly, and that's it's been implemented more smoothly now than it was before. What else would you guys like to know?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what.
Why? Why?
But okay. Why? This obviously. The why, if this doesn't appeal to you, then it won't appeal to you. It's not trying to vie with the iPhone. It's trying to be something different. So this is something that's quite popular with sysadmins, for example, who need a keyboard to use the the low level languages. Sorry, not low level, but you know what I mean. Text based languages rather than a GUI, and.
What text-based languages?
Sorry, I don't mean languages, John. I just mean using the command prompt, for example, to issue. So if you're using PowerShell, then you actually it's far better to have a proper keyboard there than it is to have a, try and use a visual keyboard.
But it's far better to have a 9-10-inch screen than a 6-inch screen if you're programming. It's...
But no, I'm with Tim. It's not for sitting and writing your code on. It's for having in your pocket so that when you get a phone call, you're on a train and someone says the server's gone down, you can SSH in and like find out what's going on, and you've got a proper keyboard that you can type into a bash shell or whatever. I get that. I think it's
I do that on my phone.
Well, you can, but it's probably rather nicer with this keyboard. Not that I've tried this keyboard or that I know what phone you have, but that would be my guess.
Mm-hmm.
So price, should we just cover that briefly? So
it, I am
right
sat
now,
down.
Right now.
Do I need to put the seatbelt on as well?
Possibly.
Okay.
So if you went to Planet Computer's website right now and tried to pre-order one, it would cost you $799. But if you go to Indiegogo right now, then you can still buy one for the launch price of $609. So that's quite a, if you are interested, then you should definitely go there rather than spend another £200 in 2 weeks' time. So, because I don't know how long that will stay there, because it may not stay there for long at all.
Yeah, the Indiegogo thing. I guess we talked about this with the Gemini as well. Does that give you like every confidence that this comes from a big reputable company with a good service division and, you know, a good guarantee they'll be there in 2 years to deal with any issues arising and so forth?
It's not a big company. Planet Computers is a startup. It's a I think there's about 12 of them all told. Obviously, they rely on a supplier in China to actually do a lot of the physical development. So they're outsourcing that. And so, for example, the work that they do in-house, obviously initially design, but then you've also got the software. So, for example, that interface I talked about previously for the external screen, that's all done by them. Mm-hmm. But other than that, they are very much, you know, sitting on the shoulders of the Chinese
supply chain. Yeah, no, it's fair enough. I mean, one can't criticize a company too much for being small and starting up. Everybody has to start somewhere. But just, you know, with a device that's this expensive and which has the potential to, you know, which asks you to rely on it that much, you know, it just, you know, my spidey sense tingles a little bit.
Well, and of course, it is Android, and so although it can also run Selfish and Linux, but I think most people will be actually running it on Android. So you have that familiarity. It does have the Google Play services. They've just announced that, which is obviously a bit of a plus. But at the same time, it's a customized version of Android. And so you will have to, whilst there will be over-the-air updates, you won't be getting updates at the same speed that that you would if you bought a Google phone. And the other thing to bear in mind is that some Gemini users did get quite frustrated by the slow updates from Planet Computers. As I say, small company, so if they have to do this work themselves, then it and they're developing new products, then, you know, yes, there are delays, and actually the update didn't go very smoothly. So there is a certain amount of BibleWare. You're going to a small company, you're not buying from Samsung, you're not going to Carphone Warehouse. There's you have to be a certain type of person to go for this. And it's not trying, as I say, it's not trying to be everything to all people. But at the same time, it's a British company doing something interesting, creating new hardware, new designs, and built on you know, the classic design of the Series 5, which I think is still pretty amazing today. Mm-hmm. So I do have some reservations. It's not the fastest processor. So that's always something to bear in mind. Just maybe if someone's on the page, they can just shout out the actual exact processor is, because I've forgotten. But although it's an improvement on the previous one, you're still not talking like a Snapdragon 855. It's going to be mid-table in the results pages.
It's a MediaTek P70, but it's got four A73 cores and four A53 cores. So it's not rubbish.
Yeah. And it's got 6 gigabytes of RAM versus 4 gigabytes previously. So that should also help it just run a little bit more smoothly. And then you've got a 24 megapixel even camera, which frankly looks okay. We're all so spoiled these days with the cameras. I'm holding a P30 Pro, Huawei P30 Pro in my hand here. The results from this will just blow the results from the Cosmo out of the water. But at the same time, at least it now has a camera, whereas the previous one didn't, so you had to buy an external unit. So yeah, it's all very positive from that point of view. Price, it is a lot. I will confess, it's a lot of money. But there's so much nice work in here. I think it'd be wrong to dismiss it just because it's expensive. It's worth thinking about what do you do with a phone? And for the first time, you could actually just get rid of your phone, I think, rather than just relying on the Gemini PDA.
Yeah, that's where it falls down for me, because it's as much as I've done some nice marketing shots of a lovely lady in the on the Indiegogo page, it is big. It is not something I want to put in my jean pocket. And so it then falls into that kind of secondary device gap where, you know, the iPad Pro feels for me. And it just has too many shortcomings, I think, to replace the iPad in that sense. Because it's not, for me, you know, I love the Scion 5, don't get me wrong. And I've played with this thing briefly at CES, and I think the quality's fine, the keyboard looks fine, but it's just, I don't see what purpose it serves. It's too close to a mobile phone, but comes with too many compromises for me.
I have to agree. I mean, I was a complete fan of my Scion 5 back in the days. It was a wonderful mobile computing platform stuff, and I really hammered mine for years, and it was great. The problem I have with a device like this is, unfortunately, my iPhone 11 Max Pro, whatever it is just so bloody good and does most everything you could possibly want. And it's a singular item that sits in your pocket, and it does go in Jim's pocket. To have one of these things, to get undoubtedly some benefits of a keyboard, I do get that, means carrying a second device with me. And a second device like this is going to be a pain to carry around. And it's unfortunately pushed into a niche amongst a niche amongst a niche because of that. And that's why outside of certain verticals or certain specific apps, or, you know, traveling salesman app or something, it's simply going to be too limiting, I'm afraid.
Okay, so that's a cold. Barry's a cold. Darren, did you explicitly go cold on me there? I didn't quite.
No, I haven't explicitly gone either way. And in fact, you know, the more I think about it, the more I think that I also had a Scion 5 back in the 90s when I was a proper techie working in an IT department. And I think if I were back in that role, and if I were making that sort of money again, I could very easily see myself treating myself to one of these things to throw in my satchel. It would be a second device. I would probably get as much joy, if I'm honest, from the geeky, nichey quirkiness of it as the actual practical functionality of it. But, you know, that's often the way with the hardware that we decide is hot. And yeah, I mean, I personally have strong feelings about keyboards anyway. So I think, although, you know, I'm struggling to think of any individual whom I would recommend this to wholeheartedly, I'm going to say it is nevertheless hot.
Okay. If you would like to cast your votes, I know some people have already, but if you'd like to cast your votes now on Mixlr, then please do. But as I look through it, so I'm hot, and I think part of that is it's hot with a little bit of suspension. So it's like a suspended sentence, exactly like Nick Kyrgios got from the ATP the other week. So that's for all the tennis fans.
All the tennis references out there.
So I want to use it, and they will be sending me one to have a play with. But really, I want to use it for 6 months and see if I am still using it in 6 months. Because one thing that's come out of this podcast is that there are some interesting new ways to use phones, potentially. I know this is a retro step, really, but this could work well for me as someone who types a lot of words and could actually enjoy it in their pocket, and also thinks back very fondly of that year-long agenda. Do you remember that, John? Guys, that was one of the highlights of these things, of the Scion. You can see at a glance your whole year, or zoom to a month or whatever, and it's so better than Google Calendar has ever managed. So I'm hot with reservations. So as I go through the quotes from Mixlr, we've got Russ Reed saying it's cold as it is outside, way too expensive. Zed Morrow agrees. We've got a couple of people who've been put off by the price, basically. So Ryan T says, I would like one, but it's only hot if the 800 quid was burning a hole in my pocket. David Artis likes the idea of it, but thinks the price makes it too cold. And Potster says, you can't see Jonathan Bray doing a deep dive on this one. And for that reason, I'm out. So we've got that seems to be a fair reflection of opinion. Oh, late one from Mike CR, too niche for me, so cold, but could be good for someone else. Exactly that. All right, guys, unless you've got anything to add, we have run over our allotted hour, so it's time to say goodbye. So thank you to everyone for listening. Thank you, John, Barry and Darian for taking part. And until our next podcast in 2 weeks, goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.